is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's a huge first step. It's an incredibly important judgment. It's an incredibly important sentence. It demonstrates to all South Africans that our courts will not stand for this type of behavior, for this crass abuse of power.
That's lawyer Glenice Breitenbach, under South Africa's former crime intelligence chief, being sentenced to 5 years in prison. Details coming up. Also, a civil court in France has ruled the Rwandan genocide suspect, Felicien Kabuga, can be transferred to a UN tribunal in Tanzania. And Cameroon has launched a campaign to encourage parents to send their children to schools that were closed in rebel conflict areas. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Term limits were once a critical element of checks and balances in Africa, given the relative weakness of independent democratic institutions such as the legislature, judiciary, civil service, security forces, media, and central bank. But since 2015, leaders of 13 countries, including Egypt, Algeria, Rwanda, and Republic of the Congo, have evaded or overseen the weakening of term limit restrictions. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, about what prompted such a reversal and its impact on governance.
What we have seen is that there were leaders who were democratically elected, though weren't committed to upholding democratic norms, including respecting term limits. Therefore, when they reached the end of their terms, they decided to test those norms. And unfortunately, the domestic checks and balances were weak. And moreover, the regional and international pressures were insufficient to constrain them to not seek a third term, often through dubious legal maneuvers. And as a result, they were able to stay in power. And this has sent a message to others. I think good examples of this are in Burundi and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. In Burundi, Pierre Nkurunziza very clearly was supposed to step down in 2015. He refused to do so, but the East African community was very timid in its response. Some of the international guarantors of the Arusha Peace Accord, South Africa, Tanzania, the United States, and others also didn't step in strongly enough. So he was able to stay in power, albeit with a lot of instability and violence that Burundi suffers from to this day.
So what are the consequences of evading term limits in Africa for Africa's governance, security, and economic development?
Term limits aren't just an end in themselves, but they're intended as a measure of improving governance in Africa, where there are weak legacies of checks and balances. And so we've seen a very strong relationship between term limits and better governance. In countries where there are term limits, the average time in office for leaders is about 4 years. For countries where there aren't term limits, that leader has been in office for an average of 17 years. Likewise, with regards to security, 9 of the 10 civil conflicts we see in Africa, excluding those involving militarist groups, involve countries whose leaders have not upheld term limits. Likewise, you know, of the 29 million forcibly displaced people in Africa, nearly 90% of these are coming from countries where leaders have evaded term limits. So the consequences for security and governance are fairly profound.
Corruption is a challenge in many African countries, particularly in countries without term limits. What is the relationship between corruption and evading term limits?
Well, we see a very strong relationship. In fact, for all leaders who've been in power for more than 10 years, there tends to be an acceleration of corruption. And the reason for this is that leaders who don't face term limits usually don't face other types of checks and balances either. So the views of leader, in effect, become the application of the rule of law. And so there's great scope for him to engage in, you know, either personalized or systematic corruption. And indeed, this is borne out in the data, and just one illustration, looking at Transparency International's Corruption Perception Index, we see that in Africa, for countries where leaders have evaded term limits, the median ranking of those countries is 145th out of 180 countries. And that's 57 places lower than the median for countries where there are term limits.
African countries used to look up for Egypt as a leader. But with a popular uprising that removed President Hosni Mubarak after 30 years in power, the Minister of Defense, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, led a coup in 2013. And after that, he amended the constitution to keep himself in power, possibly till 2034. What kind of message did this evolution send to Africa?
Well, I think the coup in Egypt was a watershed in Africa because it showed other African militaries that it was possible for militaries to play an explicit role in politics. And, you know, this comes after a period of two decades where we had seen a gradual withdrawal of the military from politics. There have been a dramatic decline in the number of coups that we had seen in Africa. However, when the Egyptian military retook control in Egypt, it was replicated in other places. And so since that time, militaries in Zimbabwe, Sudan, Burundi, Algeria, Mali, all have taken on political roles in either displacing leaders or acting more explicitly as the power behind the throne in these countries. And so it marks a significant reversal from the pattern we had seen previously.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga today lost his court battle to stay in France to be tried on allegations that he bankrolled the 1994 mass killings. Instead, France's top civil court ruled that he can be transferred to a United Nations tribunal in Tanzania. It dismissed defense efforts to portray the 87-year-old Kabuga as too frail to travel. Kabuga has rejected allegations that he imported huge numbers of machetes for ethnic Hutu militias who killed hundreds of thousands of Tutsis and moderate Hutus in Rwanda during the 100-day period. He is also accused of setting up the Interahamwe militia that carried out massacres, as well as the radio television Libre de Mille Collines, whose broadcasts incited people to murder. International Edition Steve Miller spoke with reporter Catherine Field about the case.
Essentially, the court heard several arguments, but the main two were that France is in a better position to be able to try Kabuga on these crimes than the UN tribunal. And the second, which was the one that they really thought, the defense lawyers had thought, would have a resonance with the court, and that was his medical state. They kept saying that Monsieur Kabuga is in a really delicate medical state. He's aged in his 80s. He's suffering from diabetes. And they put to the court that they were not satisfied that he would have access to medical treatment if he was in Tanzania or even in The Hague. And they said to the court, he needs medical assistance all the time. He's receiving medical treatment at the prison, and he needs to have that medical treatment on hand, and pointed out to the court that a French doctor had given the okay only for Monsieur Kabuga to go from the court to the prison and nowhere else. And they said that that was evidence that he couldn't be transferred out of France. That, of course, was rejected by this highest French court.
This decision is relatively new, but has the defense released any statements or said what they plan on doing next?
They have indeed. They have at least 1 month to hand Monsieur Kabuga over to the UN. During the hearing, when it was questioned whether or not it was safe, given the coronavirus pandemic, to send Monsieur Kabuga on a plane to Arusha in Tanzania, where the mechanism sits, And the court heard that they had guarantees from the UN that, yes, in the first instance, it would be up to The Hague, the officers of the UN Tribunal in The Hague, to sort all this out. So clearly, the French court got the assurances they wanted. So they have 1 month to hand them over. The only other possibility at this stage for Monsieur Kabuga is that he now appeals to the European Court of Human Rights. He can go to them and he can say, listen, you know, my rights are not being respected here.
Catherine, you also had the opportunity to speak with the lawyer representing the Rwandan genocide victims. What's been their reaction?
Well, on the one side, they were happy that this is the beginning of the end for the impunity that Monsieur Kabuga had. Let's not forget that he was on the run for 26 years. On the other side, they are saying that they're not happy that he's going to be handed over to a UN tribunal because they would rather that he was tried in Rwanda. And the reason for them saying that is that at a UN tribunal, it's up to the prosecutor to decide whether or not the witnesses, the Rwandans who actually witnessed the genocide or had family members who were killed during the genocide, it's up to the prosecutor to decide whether they can take part in the trial. So that doesn't really suit them. They would like to have their day in court as well. They would like to be able to have their own processes, their legal process against this man who is alleged financed most of the Rwanda genocide.
That was reporter Catherine Field speaking from Paris with International Edition's Steve Miller. The World Health Organization reports anyone found to have sexually exploited and abused women seeking work in its Ebola aid operation in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo will face serious consequences. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Health Agency says it is outraged by these allegations. It says it has a zero-tolerance policy with regard to sexual exploitation and abuse and plans a thorough investigation to get to the bottom of this totally unacceptable behavior. An investigation by the New Humanitarian and the Thomson Reuters Foundation found more than 50 women were forced to trade sex for a job in the international Ebola aid operation in eastern DRC. The women have accused male aid workers from the World Health Organization and leading non-governmental organizations of abusing them. WHO spokeswoman Fadela Shaib tells VOA an investigation will seek to uncover the identities of the men who reportedly abused the women and determine whether the allegations are true.
If WHO staff, partners, or contractors are guilty of this allegation, WHO will take firm decision, disciplinary decision against them, immediate dismissal, or we can end our contracts with contractors or consultants.
Much of the alleged abuse reportedly occurred in the eastern city of Beni, which was the epicenter of a nearly two-year-long Ebola epidemic that killed 2,229 people before it ended in June. WHO currently is tackling another Ebola outbreak in Equateur province. The virus so far has infected 112 people, including 48 deaths. Shaib says WHO's director general takes the allegations of sexual abuse seriously and has ordered an immediate, thorough, and transparent investigation.
We are there to help vulnerable population, including women, and we will not tolerate this behavior from staff, contractors, or partners. Only the investigation will tell us who these perpetrators are, and we will do an investigation and go public about our findings.
WHO has many policies and mechanisms in place, including mandatory training programs to prevent sexual abuse. It also has set up hotlines where victims can report violations and seek help. Shaib says WHO recognizes even the best policies can go awry. She says every year, WHO reports to the member states all misconduct about which it is informed, including fraud, corruption, and sexual abuse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africa's former crime intelligence chief has been sentenced to 5 years in prison for kidnapping and severely assaulting his ex-lover's husband. Richard Midluli escaped arrest for a long list of alleged crimes when his friend and political ally Jacob Zuma was president from 2009 to early 2018. But as Darren Taylor reports, his luck has run out. Zuma's gone and he is dealing with his own legal issues.
Midluli and an accomplice were convicted of abducting and assaulting his former girlfriend's husband, Opa Ramohibe, in 1998. At the time, Midluli was commander of a police station east of Johannesburg. In what remains an unsolved murder, Ramohibe was shot dead a few months after filing charges against Midluli. The then police commander was a suspect, but wasn't charged. However, in 2011, 2 years after Zuma appointed him as boss of crime intelligence, Midluli and his accomplice were indeed charged, but only for the kidnap and assault of Ramohibe.
Why they weren't charged with murder is anybody's guess.
Lawyer Glynis Breitenbach eventually had to leave South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority, or NPA, after she began pushing for Midluli to face justice. She explains that soon after Midluli was charged in 2011, another Zuma appointee, then NPA chief Lawrence Mkhwebi, decided there was no evidence against him. Breitenbach says the jailing of Midluli is vindication for everyone who's been fighting for the rule of law to prevail.
It's a huge first step. It's an incredibly important judgment. It's an incredibly important sentence. It demonstrates to all South Africans that our courts will not stand for this type of behavior, for this crass abuse of power, and that if the police investigate effectively and the prosecution services prosecute efficiently, then there are consequences for bad behavior. So it's an incredible...
Breitenbach believes there's enough evidence to charge Midluli with many crimes he allegedly committed when he directed crime intelligence.
The list is endless, but you know the matter that Midluli faces in the Specialized Commercial Crime Court is one of fraud and theft. It's a big matter. I believe that there's a strong case, and I've every reason to believe that it will be prosecuted as effectively. So,
Midluli faces charges of fraud, corruption, theft, and defeating the ends of justice for allegedly stealing millions of rands from crime intelligence coffers.
There are a bunch of people, along with Midluli, who should be on their way to jail, and they must be feeling quite nervous, and they certainly won't sleep well tonight.
Early next year, a court's expected to decide whether to charge Midluli with Ramohibe's murder. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Cameroon has launched a campaign to encourage parents to send their children to schools that were closed in rebel conflict areas and for fleeing teachers to return. Cameroon authorities want the schools to reopen by October 5th and say the areas are secure, but some parents and teachers question the safety of returning to the schools. Cameroon's military liberated more than 100 schools from rebel occupation in weekend fighting that left at least 9 rebels and several troops dead, as Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
Cameroon's Ministry of National Education says it has dispatched hundreds of its staff members to English-speaking regions to campaign for schools to reopen on October 5th. Bernard Mbuel, a pedagogic inspector, is one of them. He says the future of 400,000 children is at risk should schools remain closed.
When education is attacked, you have a generation that is failing. There is no succession. You have increase in cycles of crisis because conflict cannot be resolved when the children are not educated. You find children evolving while those that are conflict-stricken cannot evolve. The children will not be competitive in the job market because they are not educated.
41-year-old laboratory technician Philomena Aye fled fighting in the English-speaking northwestern town of Batibo to the capital Yaounde in July. She says she wants her younger siblings to have education, without which their future remains bleak in a highly competitive world.
I'm really glad for the children to go back to school. They should go and learn. They have forgotten so many things. For now, they are in the house. They only eat. It's not really easy. Play. They have forgotten so many things.
Cameroon's military reports that within the past 4 days, troops chased separatist fighters from at least 100 schools in the English-speaking Northwest region. The Catholic Church in the area said the corpses of 2 soldiers were seen in the northwestern village of Kikaikelaki. Deben Chofo, the region's governor, did not confirm troops were killed, but says at least 9 separatist fighters lost their lives and 12 others were arrested in Kumbu, Ndop, Santa, Bafut, and Wum.
It wasn't an easy process, but they are doing their utmost best to secure the region. And it is hoped that come 5th of October, we must have improved on the security in this region to allow schools to resume. We have asked the population to organize themselves in vigilante group to create security around the school.
Chofo said the attacks on schools used by fighters as hideouts is carried out at the same time as the campaign to reopen the schools. Separatist spokesperson Capo Daniel admits that some fighters were attacked. Capo says the separatists now want privately owned schools to reopen in the country's Anglophone regions after 4 years of closure. He says fighters have been asked to keep government schools closed.
In terms of the Cameroon government schools, we have complete non-tolerance, which is a complete ban of all schools that are sponsored or functioning under the Cameroon Ministry of National Education. In areas that we control, we have opened up community schools and the teachers who are providing the educations are doing so on a voluntary basis.
The government of Cameroon this week said the military will escort teachers and students who want to return to schools in various towns and villages. 26-year-old teacher Shuri Quinta, who escaped from Kumbo to Yaoundé after she was attacked in June for encouraging schools to reopen, says their security is not assured.
Continuous kidnapping and beating of staff and students of these regions is an indication of inadequate security. I so much long for schools to reopen brought in a secured atmosphere. It therefore falls on both sides of the ongoing conflict to guarantee the security and to institute confidence-building measures. Otherwise, we are going to be heading for an illiterate society and its associated ills.
The United Nations says Cameroon's 4-year separatist conflict has left over 3,000 people dead and 500,000 displaced. The crisis started in 2016 when teachers and lawyers took to the streets to campaign about the overbearing influence of the French language in the bilingual country. The military responded with a crackdown and separatists took up weapons, claiming that they were defending civilians. They asked for a school shut down and vowed to make the English-speaking regions ungovernable. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyu Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports.